The Anton Savage Show
with Kearies.ie
on News Talk.
We're joined by Grainne Nier, news reporter Breed Smith from People Before Profit, and Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD. If you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent, or you can get us 087 1400 106. And the analysis of 2FM's act of seppuku continues with an awful lot of newspaper inches dedicated to what do they do now? Do they shut up shop, roll down the shutters and do something completely different? How did they get themselves into this position? What was the motivating factor for the mass exodus and all of that kind of thing? Noel, let me start with the end of those. From the coverage that you are reading and what you have heard and seen, the reason for the mass exodus.
Well, it looks like across the different papers, the speculation within RTE about the reason for the mass exodus is that the contracts are now becoming restrictive in terms of external activities for a lot of these presenters who would have quite large social media followings, quite large podcast audiences, and accordingly, along with that, quite large commercial contracts. And so this is becoming increasingly incompatible with the relatively restrictive contracts that are being put on them by 2FM following the recent revelations about RTE, where RTE is becoming a little bit more, I suppose, restrictive about what presenters can be doing externally. And that's making it an unattractive proposition for these presenters. And they've decided, you know what? I could do better off outside RTE rather than inside RTE.
To what extent, Grainne, is this RTE reaping what it sowed? Because RTE made a strategic decision, or at least 2FM made a strategic decision, to hire people specifically because of the scale of external audience they had. They got into the business of hiring celebs with big social media platforms rather than broadcasters. Had they not done that, would they be here?
Well, I dispute whether these are overly restrictive. Like, as far as I understand, it is a declaration of other interests. It's not that you can't do things outside, but there has to be a clear line of demarcation. You can't post social media videos within RTE studios. I don't think that's overly prohibitive. I think it's just creating a certain degree of lines of separation so that when they are advertising on social media, it's not through the RTE brand. I don't think that is unfair. But
is there also a requirement to declare income?
I think there is as well. But again, you know, I think it is just that there is a focus on it, and that is uncomfortable for some people. And, you know, there's a piece by Sarah McGuinness in the Business Post today that says, you know, radio shows are increasingly self-produced by presenters, purse strings are tighter, playlists dictated by market research on 2FM. And then she also says that for the two Johnnies, they had an audience, an average episode of their programme on radio, the podcast eclipses that of their 2FM show by almost five times over. I think there was another piece in one of the papers a couple of weeks ago when Darren Garrahy left that said her Instagram following is twice the amount of her radio listenership. So I think that is more the core of the issue. As someone said to me during the week, the RTE show is the side gig. The thrust of their income is their social media followings, those extra gigs that they do. And I think that represents how there has been a shift in the media industry. But what does 2FM do?
I'm not sure that applies across the entire media industry. It was 2FM who made this choice. I mean, 2FM went and hired Darren Garrahy because she had a huge social media platform, the two Johnnies because they had a huge social media platform, and Donal O'Callaghan because he brought with him a huge amount of celebrity. These were not at the time seasoned broadcasters. That's not to suggest they weren't good broadcasters, but they didn't come in with a broadcasting pedigree. I think 2FM is man alone in that. I don't see any other stations doing
that.
But
I think it is what I meant by the media strategy is it is trying to encourage young people. This is an outsider's view. I don't have any inside knowledge of this, but the broadcaster is trying to attract younger listeners by bringing on social media stars and their followers. And Dan Healy was talking during the week about this. And, you know, he said about the two Johnnies, we knew they were not ours. They were not our stars, and that they were with us for just a time. And if that's a strategy, is that fair? You take on social media stars for a bit, try and pull some of their listeners, and when they leave, you hope some of them linger around. I mean, I think there needs to be a bit more creativity within RTE in particular about how it attracts new listeners.
Breed Smith, if you look at the existential issue now faced by 2FM, because paraphrasing Oscar Wilde, losing one presenter is one thing, having your entire daytime schedule walk off is a particular challenge. Would you close the doors?
I hope listeners forgive me, but I yawn and fall asleep talking about this subject. I've no I've no real feeling about it one way or the other. But I think that it's clear that 2FM are in trouble. What's even clearer to me is that young people don't really listen to radio that much. They more use the social media platforms, and that's where, and what Grania's just given us there, the stats about the followers of the various people who are leaving, that's quite remarkable. But what RTÉ are writing doing, and I agree with them on this, and they must do it because it's a publicly funded broadcaster, is looking for transparency over funding and earnings and outside interests. That's absolutely correct thing to do.
Does that apply across all of their output? Because you could make an argument that says that if you are in news and current affairs, that you need to be that kind of do that kind of declaration. But does it really matter if Darren Gary's getting a few quid off Lavent?
I think it does, because the because of the public funding aspect of RTÉ. That's the point. Not whether you're in news or whether you're talking, you know, about fashion and food and stuff. The point is that you're being funded by the public purse, so there needs to be absolute transparency. There hasn't been in the past, and that's what brought them into deep cold water in the last year or so.
So what do they do now, Noel?
Well, I think they need to think a bit more long-term, first of all, when it comes to presenter recruitment and retention. This idea of short-term fixes and hiring people solely because they're social media stars or solely because they have a social media audience is inevitably short-termist by its nature. What they need to be doing is looking at how they can develop talent, how they can bring along talent, how they can do things a bit more creatively in 2FM. If they keep going down the road that they've been going down for the last decade, well, we've seen what happens. The audiences are in decline, generally speaking, and there are simply too many competing platforms, be it commercial radio or podcasts or kind of any number of other places where young people can go. So I think 2FM needs a bit of a refresh and a bit of a rethink. But I have to say, a rare bit of Fine Gael PBP solidarity, completely agree with Breed. I think transparency is absolutely essential for all of these presenters on a state broadcaster. It's different for a commercial broadcaster, but for a state broadcaster, this is public money ultimately, and we need to be able to know what presenters are saying and why they're saying it.
Even if what they are saying is coming up next, Dua Lipa.
Even if what they're saying is coming up next, Dua Lipa, I think if they're promoting certain products after hours, we should know about that.
In terms of the impact on this financially, I remember doing a calculation once on, and people always say, oh, sure, is any individual presenter that important to an organisation? But I remember doing the maths on Gerry Ryan's departure and the diminution of the audience that was directly precipitated by his departure. And it added up over a 10-year period to about 58 million quid that RTÉ lost by not having Gerry Ryan continue to broadcast. Do you expect a similar impact from the departure of the two Johnnies?
No, and I hope they don't find that disrespectful if they hear this, but no, I don't think so. I think given the level of audience 2FM currently has, I don't think you'll see a massive cliff drop-off or anything like that. If you'll forgive me to use a News Talk name for a second, Anton, Pat Kenny's departure from RTÉ and Sean O'Rourke taking over from that particular slot, it was seen as precipitating a massive drop-off there. That actually didn't happen in the end. News Talk's figures improved dramatically with the arrival of Pat Kenny, but RTÉ's didn't fall off massively with Sean O'Rourke taking his place.
I think one of the things that I heard during the RTÉ debacle is that it's actually the format that listeners like. The form, if they like a format, it kind of doesn't massively matter who is in the chair if the format appeals to them. So even though a lot of the shows are named after presenters, it is actually the structure that people find familiar and find appealing. As long as someone isn't too irritating to their ears, they won't switch over.
Takes a lot of pressure off it.
But I think that one of the things I found really interesting in the papers is a piece in the Mail on Sunday today. And they make the point that there is no definition of public service broadcasting. You know, to entertain, to inform, to educate, there's no weighting to which one of those mm-hmm. you're supposed to do in proportion. So if you're entertaining the whole time, there's no, that's within the remit because that's one of the three, but it doesn't say you need to give equal weight to all three or anything like that. I think that would be a massive help because I think a lot of the issues that people have about why things are done a certain way in RTÉ is defended by the public service broadcasting mantra when that's actually not that clear. So I think
there's also a sense that public service broadcasting has to be the broadcasting equivalent of broccoli, that it has to be kind of distasteful and good for you. Whereas if you look at 2FM, if 2FM is providing an outlet for young Irish music, young Irish bands, for that kind of thing, that is a public service remit, even if it's not Brian Dobson telling us what's happened in Gaza.
But that's another point. You know, for example, highlighting Irish talent or young Irish people coming up to the fore, that is very obviously public service broadcasting, but maybe it's more difficult. Maybe on paper it doesn't look like that would attract listeners or people would tune in for that instead of playing Dua Lipa or Taylor Swift or something like that. But there is an obligation to do that despite the pull to attract or to play big names because they are Irish artists who need airing. And you don't know, CMAT, for example, is a massive star doing really well internationally. If you air people, people will flock to it by just familiarity. And I think that's what I meant by creative thinking, like that you have to make brave decisions and put things out there and try new things, even if the old format is steady and stable. It kind of, there's a big rewards to be get by going out on a limb on these things. But yeah, I do think it is part of the wider kind of RTE discussion. And one thing that really, I think there's a lot of talented broadcasters out there if they are given a chance and don't reach for, in a kind of a similar point, don't reach for another rugby star to put in front of a microphone. Pick someone young, enthusiastic, who really, like, there's not a lot of jobs in broadcasting or media. Give them a chance.
Reid Smith, the other question then in all of this is, how do you pay for the totality of it? Because it all comes back to this thing of licence fee and whether or not it is going to be through Exchequer or whether it is going to be a media charge or whatever else. What's your view?
Well, I think we've put in a proposal in the recent past during the debacle with RTE that the funding for public service broadcasting should be done by way of a levy or a tax on the tech, you know, the sort of media that makes a lot of money out of online stuff, out of advertising, but doesn't pay extra taxes on it. So if you look at Facebook or X, the amount of money they make out of the advertising that happens should be taxed. There should be a small tax on it that would, and they make a huge amount of money that would come back to fund public broadcasting, not taking the licence fee from people.
You'd ring fence one to the other.
Yes, yeah. Take money from the media, the broadcasting media, online media, that makes a huge amount out of advertising.
So RTE's fortunes would be based on Facebook's advertising sales?
Well, you would get a tax from that. No, it's not that their fortunes are based on, it's that you would take a tax from them to publicly fund broadcasting.
But are you saying that the one is ring-fenced to the other, or simply then ultimately what you're doing is just funding out of the Exchequer? Just Exchequer funding, is it?
No. It's putting an extra tax on the online media companies to fund public broadcasting.
But that means then if Facebook's ad sales go down in a given year or if they depart the country and aren't available to pay that tax, then the amount that RTE gets paid goes down.
Well, technically, yes, it would, but that's not happening. Facebook's advertising, X's advertising, all of the platforms are making an absolute fortune.
And so did Bebo on MySpace, but it didn't continue.
Well, I mean, the proposal is only being worked out, but I think it's proper to take extra taxation from the companies that are making a fortune on online advertising.
I get the sense in this, Noel, that there is not a lot of appetite to go near the issue of how this funding is addressed until post-election, post-general election. Am I wrong on that?
I mean, Pascal Donoghue obviously has some comments today in one of the papers, I think it's the Sunday Times, in relation to this and gives his views and sets out his stall in relation to it. But there is a truth, Anton, in the sense that it has been running on for quite a while at this stage. I've paid my licence fee twice since this saga started, essentially, and I found myself wondering last year, I wonder how this will work out by the time the next licence fee payment comes. And now I've paid again since in the meantime. And meanwhile, we're no closer to a solution. So there is a question mark over the desire to bring about this change in short order, first of all. And second of all, what exactly this change will look like. Like I said, Pascal Donoghue does set out his views today and they are reasonably clear. And he does make the point that he doesn't think...
He wants licence fees.
Yeah, and he doesn't think it would be appropriate to link it explicitly to Exchequer funding because there are problems there around independence, I suppose. And I think that's a very fair and considered point from Minister Donoghue. But we do need to figure out what exactly are we doing and ideally get this done before the election.
What of that matter, Breach? Do you think there is much appetite to go near this until the general?
No, I don't. I don't, to be honest with you. There's a lot of things they don't want to go near until they get past an election. And very clearly, getting rid of the triple lock is one thing they won't touch till after the locals and the European elections. We've only 4 days left in the Dáil and that is not on the agenda. So we can see that they're waiting till after the election, even though Micheál Martin keeps saying, I'll get this through by the summer. There's lots of things they won't touch because of an election.
Well, on the topic of the election, we were talking general, but obviously locals and Europeans on the way. The Business Post has a big Red Sea poll with good news for your conglomeration, Breed. People Before Profit Solidarity Alliance up 1%.
We're not really a conglomeration now, Anton.
What's the proper term? I always think of you as a conglomeration. Party would be a
party.
My apologies.
Yeah, we're up 1% nationally and 2% on the local elections. So that's good news.
The headline out of it, of course, is that Sinn Féin is -4. And the way that the paper is interpreting that is now very much an established downward trend for Sinn Féin. We'll analyse that with Breed Smith from People Before Profit, Gráinne Ié and Noel Rock. Texas say RTE is stuck in another century. They've next to no podcast offering while their playback player services are archaic. Until they catch up with how people consume media today, then their decline will continue. If you've just tuned in, that's off the back of us discussing an awful lot of coverage in respect of 2FM, why there was the mass exodus and what now for the station. I was discussing it with Breed Smith from People Before Profit, Gráinne Ié, news reporter, and Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD. And according to the Business Post, it may not be a good time to be a former Fine Gael anything because their fortunes seem to be turning. Noel, Fine Gael +2, Sinn Féin -4.
Yeah, indeed. Sinn Féin down 4, outside the margin of error. So significant enough drop for Sinn Féin in this poll, kind of replicating a trend we've seen across all different polling companies across a number of months now, where they've kind of sagged down from a midterm high of about 35-36% and now moving into that kind of mid-20s range. A number of issues kind of underpinning that. They're clearly having difficulty in relation to the migration issues that are happening right now, and clearly people aren't really buying a lot of what they're saying in relation to law and order as well. So it's a challenging time for Sinn Féin.
Now explain that, because they have been saying what they've been saying about law and order for some time and people did buy it.
Well, I think since the riots in November, you'll find that was actually kind of correlated quite closely with Sinn Féin's drop in the polling. Like, it has been pretty consistent since around autumn of last year, right through to where we are now. So I think this is yet another example of Sinn Féin dropping in popularity. I think people are questioning now exactly what they stand for in relation to that migration issue in particular. They seem to be taking a more anti-migration stance than some of the more mainstream parties at this stage, whereas they were previously presenting themselves as a liberal, more centre-left party. So that's a little bit confusing for their own supporters, I think. And you're seeing quotes to that effect beginning to appear off the record in a lot of these places.
And the up arrow for Fine Gael, is that a Simon Harris bounce?
You'd have to think so. He has brought a lot of energy to the party, which we haven't had for a long time now. That said, you have to be humble about these things. I mean, it's 22%. It's not like we're at 44% or anything like that. It's still all to play for, it's quite clear. And I know up and down the country today, there'll be candidates from Fine Gael, yes, but from all parties, knocking on doors and battling away and trying their best to get their own messages out there. But for Fine Gael, yeah, encouraging, sir.
And encouraging news for People Before Profit and Solidarity as well, up 1%. But of course, 1% is if you're not in double figures, it is a significant up. Breed, the issue, all the papers, or rather the Business Post, are saying that immigration is at the heart of a lot of what's causing the move in the polls. Would you accept that?
I would, yeah. And I think that I think it's in relation to Sinn Féin, I think it's really tragic that they didn't take their focus off the housing issue. But what they didn't do was to mobilise their base on the housing issue. I was on a small but perfectly formed protest yesterday about housing, and we got no support from Sinn Féin. We got no support from the trade union movement. We got no support from the other left parties. And throughout the whole housing crisis, we have been trying really hard to bring a movement together that would do what the water charges did and would put pressure on the political system to concede on housing, that public and affordable housing had to be the central issue. And tragically, Sinn Féin and the trade union movement and the other left parties have failed to mobilise on this. I think it's a real shame. And I think, to be honest with you, that they're paying the price of that, because if you're not mobilising people on the issue that most concerns them, which is housing, then the other issue that is being used to target away people's attention and being very sinisterly used by certain groups who are trying to gain momentum on the far right is the question of migration. Of course, there is a challenge and of course, there is a real issue here. But to blame migrants on housing, to blame them on health, to blame them on the fact that you can't get a GP, to blame them on the fact that we're short of dentists is absolutely shocking.
But Brent,
and that's what's been happening is to target them.
Will Sinn Féin not say, look at all of the work that Eoin Óibrín has done over the last number of years in terms of interacting with and engaging with the various different players across the provision of housing and coming up with an entirely alternative method for delivering housing through public sector rather than private sector, and detailed plans to so do? What more could you want?
Well, I mean, Eoin Óibrín is among a cohort of left-wing people who've done this. I mean, another would be Rory Hearn, another would be, what's his name? Sir, what's his name?
Lorcan Sir.
They've come up with really good alternatives to the housing policies that the government have. But my point is that you have to mobilise the population to demand of the government what needs to be done, rather than just sitting back and being the best kids on the block with the best policies. And I think the failure to do that is a real tragedy, not least for the people who are at the receiving end of the housing crisis, those living in overcrowded conditions, the adults who have to stay in their mammy and daddy's box bedroom. I think it's something like 500,000 adults are in this situation. It's really an extraordinary crisis, and it's not being dealt with. It's just getting worse and worse. And that's why I think the mobilisation of people power would have been a really important part of Sinn Féin maintaining their lead. And it has dropped, and it has dropped because of this issue and because they're flip-flopping all over the place on migration.
I think Sinn Féin are not the only party that have struggled to find a clear policy or approach to migration. I think the government parties have kind of struggled to react to it in a way that is both, as Simon Harris came in and said, that we're firm on law and order, to kind of pursue that through a migration lens, while also saying we want to do it in a humane way, I think has been kind of the government's approach. And they have also tried to straddle that line through their policies. And we've seen a rollback on immigration or on supports for Ukrainian refugees, and that continue as the months have gone on, in a kind of a show, I think, of how the government feels that they need to act, but they don't want to feed into the far right line, or they don't want to feed into that kind of anti-immigration protest thing and make them feel that they are winning. And they have really struggled to do that. But it is easier to say in government, we are doing a policy here, we are doing a policy there, than to be in opposition and to say, well, you should be doing this, but you should also be, you know. So I think that's where the trouble for Sinn Féin has been.
Advantage to opposition is that you have the capacity to promise the devil or not.
Well, I think they don't know what they want to promise. Sinn Féin is the problem. And like, you know, you could see them kind of, I think, on a day where immigration was very big, that RTE were raised. And I think that has been a struggle. But I will say as well, since Sinn Féin had that historic election win, general election or result in the last general election, everyone has known that the voters were voting for change. And those voters all had a different idea of what change was. And as the years have gone on, and Sinn Féin has articulated its point, which it's entitled to do, this is what we stand for, voters have said, well, that actually wasn't my idea of change, or actually that's not the change I want. And there has been a splintering that I think everyone knew was inevitable, as you just take a stance on the topic of splintering,
this is one, Noel, that I want your view on, because whenever you get a poll and you ask a sitting politician, you get the standard cliche, but a snapshot in time. So setting aside snapshots in time and looking at trend lines, the Business Post has trended it out in line graphs. And if we go back effectively 2 years, the Fine Gael up in this recent poll, who knows, we'd need to see before it becomes a trend. Fianna Fáil bouncing more or less along. But if you look for a trend, there are two very clear lines. There is the diminution of support of Sinn Féin corresponding in direct parallel with a significant increase in independence. That's where the vote seems to be going.
Yeah, in reality, if we take a zoomed out view of the whole thing and we look back over the last 2 years of the term in particular, it's quite clear that people are looking at what was formerly a blank canvas of Sinn Féin, where the details are being filled in now, like Gráinne says. And now that the details are being filled in, some people are saying, oh, actually, that isn't what I thought Sinn Féin stood for. Therefore, in the next poll, I'm going to say I'm going to someone else. I'm not going back to the government parties necessarily, but I'm not equally going to Sinn Féin. So now I'm going to go for independents, who seem to represent the kind of change.
Now, let me just caveat that with the fact of we still have Sinn Féin at 23% in the polls, largest party in the country. And there was a time when they would have had your arm off for it. So it's far from disaster for them.
Yes.
But if we look at a makeup, I mean, if we continued, and it's a big if, these kind of trends, the next all, we're looking at a mix and gatherum of independents, of necessity being in the next government, we assume.
Yeah. Now, Sinn Féin are like the 2FM presenter roster. They're down 4 right now, but they're not completely gone altogether. So look, they're at 23, and that's fine. But look, the independents clearly do represent kind of an opportunity. And this always happens, Anton, if you zoom out further, actually, to the local election cycle last time, what tends to happen as we get closer to local elections is independents do peak, because there are often a lot of independent councillors in each council ward, etc., etc. And people go, oh, actually, I like your man. He does good work locally, etc. etc., etc. So in the 2014 and 2019 local elections, the polling figures for independents actually peaked at both those occasions as well. So this does tend, it's somewhat cyclical
there's,
by nature.
There's also a point that Micheál Martin made during the week, which I think is interesting, because they have a good chunk of independent, or a good chunk of local election, or local councillors. They make a good proportion of it, 279, I think. But basically, he said that at local election level, you kind of don't see the party as clearly as you do at a national level. So the national poll might say, you know, this amount, but for the party doesn't matter as much as the recognition of a certain candidate and what mm-hmm. they do for the community. So we might see the local election, and we've seen that before in previous elections, so we might see results skewed, even though the national polls say one thing at local election level.
Reid, do you want to come in?
Yeah, just a point about independence, in inverted commas, is sometimes you have to realise that they're not really independent, that an awful lot of them stand for very specific types of politics. In this election, for example, I think in the Euros, because I'm running in Dublin, there's something like six so-called independents coming from far-right type politics, mm-hmm. Coming out of the, you know, anti-immigration stuff. And it's not like they've been active in the community, that they've been great advocates for the area they live in, or for workers, or for on an issue like housing or whatever. They've just come out of the blue on the question of immigration, and they're all in the field now, both locally and in the European elections, and calling themselves independent. I don't consider that independence. Actually, I don't really know what independence means. I mean, I sit in the Dáil to vote, I'm surrounded by so-called independents, people like Michael Lowry and Noel Grealish and all. They're all in their DNA, either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, and they all back the government on the crucial issues when it comes to voting. So tell me what a real independent is. And I'd welcome that, because I see independence as using the title to gather support, but actually not really being what one would think of as independent.
You don't see modern versions of Tony Gregory's in amongst this kind of number,
there's
no?
There's probably an odd modern version of the Tony Gregory, but not to this degree that you're seeing the polls. And people who feel themselves as independent, not being genuinely independent, is a big phenomenon.
What are you hearing on the doorsteps in relation to immigration? Because the analysis would suggest that it is one of the critical reasons that is moving the dial in relation to these kind of polls. And there doesn't seem to be anything like a solution on the horizon when you talk to the government.
Well, it's interesting, on the doors you're getting quite mixed, and I think the polls are reflecting it, because the order of priorities of issues shows that actually migration is going down in terms of its importance. So on the locals, the cost of living has gone right up. And that's a really interesting...
Well, let me just actually give that, because you're dead right, yeah. Breed. The key issues in local elections, according to the poll, number one, cost of living at 68%. Number two, health services and hospitals at 53%. Tied, housing and planning, 52%. And as you say, immigration now running at 41%.
Now, that's still high, but it's not as high as it has been. And you get a mixed reaction on the doors. I mean, I've got a very clear position. People for profit, a very clear position. We want the world to see migration as a feature of, you know, modern life, and always has been a feature of life, but it's increasingly a feature because of wars, because of climate change, because of, you know, desperate people moving across the planet at a rate of knots. But we should see it as a positive thing, or a challenge, yes, absolutely. But there's positivity in it, and that all of these people can work. And when you look at the lack of workers we have in the construction industry, in the care industry, in, you know, hospitality, shops, etc., there's loads of work to be done, and all of these people can work. Now, I know if they apply to stay in the country, they have to wait 6 months before they have the right to work. That's a shame. They shouldn't have to wait that long. Obviously, they should get Garda clearance and all the rest of it, and there's ways of doing that with Interpol, but they should be able to work. And that would mean they're simultaneously making a contribution, and all of the empty buildings in this city where we're sitting, all of the empty spaces that belong to the state, that don't belong to the state, that are office blocks, should be used to house people.
Tech saying, why are we giving any credence to these polls at all, as they got it so spectacularly wrong in the referendum? Another, it looks like the people are in the mood to replace both the government and the opposition. That was Charlie McCreevy's line about Fine Gael back in the day, wasn't it? With votes coming up, many of us are left without a party to vote for, says another view of a view. 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. No, Rock, there is, well, we're talking immigration. The Sunday Times is reporting that the funding is going to end for migrant tents, which ostensibly sounds like, well, that's a solution to the problem. But the reality, according to what Roderick O'Gorman said on this programme, was we are going to, for months, have people arriving seeking international protection whom we cannot house. They will then become homeless. If we don't supply them with tents, if we don't give them somewhere to sleep, vaguely rough, how is this an improvement?
Yeah, I mean, like, I would presume that the tent being stood down plan will mean that there's going to be an increase in homeless hubs, in other types of shelter, in kind of a hostel accommodation, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not entirely clear to me from the text of this story if that's necessarily the case. What is the case, then? What we do know, what is kind of baffling to a lot of people, is how you have one arm of the state essentially providing the funding for these tents, and then another arm of the state essentially going out and taking these tents away again and destroying these tents. And that is, like, manifestly, like, a waste of money, and also just a really inhumane way to treat people. You know, the tents aren't the biggest challenge here. It's actually the people inside the tents who need to be looked after and sheltered and be put in a safe environment.
Of which, the one bit that I couldn't get my head around in any of this was, if you are going to supply people tents because you know they will be sleeping rough, if you then say, well, what's the best thing they can do? Well, group together for your own safety. Better that than that you're trying to find a doorway to set your tent up. Yeah. And try to find somewhere where it is livable. I would have thought Grand Canal being a fine example. So they find the most logical place to go, and we then fence it off and say you can't go there.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're thinking about this in a humane and decent way, that's exactly what would happen. Like, if you or I were in that situation in another country, that's exactly what we would do. We would say, we want to stay somewhere nearby where we're processing these people. So this makes sense, because it's on Grand Canal Street there. And we want to find somewhere green, and we want to find somewhere relatively open, but not necessarily subject to weather conditions. And we want to group together. So inevitably, you end up going towards the canal or the next nearest place to it. So we saw some people down towards Ringsend there in green space, or further up the canal. That's just logical. And it's a sad reality that these people are going through, because they are people who are ultimately waiting to be processed at the end of the day.
And so have you any sense in this, Breeder, where if we're not giving out tents, what's the solution? What's this magic bullet?
I have no idea. I mean, like, it's just Noel twitched on something there about the waste of the tents themselves. I mean, the government on the one hand go on about the circular economy and the need to recycle, and there's this mass production of tents that are then scooped up and binned, and they're all made of plastic products, you know. So it's all a bit mental to me, but I'll go back to the point that there are empty buildings all over this city that could be used, including office blocks. I visited a Syrian refugee camp in Athens a few years ago, and families were being housed in the old airport terminal. So they were in out of the sun and the rain and the wind, but they all had their individual tents inside it. So they had a bit of privacy, and they had access to toilets and showers because it was an old airport building. These things are possible. In the interim, until people settle, until they get work or until they move on, we need to think about these things in
well,
a practical
it's funny
way.
Whenever we talk about it, I think it was last weekend, we got a text that said, look, if we have the capacity to put 60,000 people in tents in Stradbally for the electric picnic every year and provide services and sanitation, all the rest of it, it can't be beyond the capacity of man to deliver on this. There is much other stuff to talk about in the papers, including another call to prevent the opposition to data centres. This time's Gas Networks Ireland saying, let us build data centres, or rather, let data centres be built. If you have a view, 53106 or 087-1400-106 on WhatsApp. We'll be back after this break. It is the Anton Savage Show, 53106. If you want to get in touch, Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD, is with us, as is Gráinne Nié, news reporter, and Breed Smith from People Before Profit. And this has become, to some extent, Gráinne, a bit of a steady drumbeat now. We've heard Amazon saying it. We've heard some of the representative companies or representative associations of big tech. And now we're hearing Gas Networks Ireland say it. Lift the block on data centres. Let data centres get built in Ireland.
Yeah, but there's a bit of a proposal behind it. It's not just give us what we want. There is a kind of a tit for tat. So Daniel Murray in the Business Post is reporting that Gas Networks Ireland has asked that Ireland, as you said, as along with Amazon and Google and Microsoft, they're asking that Ireland reverse to somewhat, to some extent, its policy on not connecting data centres because it's hindering investment and their expansion, I suppose, as businesses. And they said this, they could do this as long as a chart to move to renewables is agreed upon over time. So what they say is that, you know, you could have a policy like 10% of renewable gas, that these companies would agree to that by 2025, and that that would rise to 40% of renewable gas by 2030, and that that would, under those conditions, that they would, you would connect new data centres to allow them to kind of expand their businesses. Eamon Ryan agreed in 2020, or brought in a policy in 2022 that, you know, there would be no further connections of islanded data centres because the grid is so restricted in terms of supply. And basically, Gas Networks Ireland is saying, here is a way where we could do it in a way that kind of achieves what you want to do while also achieving what we want to do.
I think it's important to start by saying, and fair play to the Business Post, they've always done good stuff on the question of data centres. And last week's Business Post, for example, or maybe it was the week before, the front page had an article on it about the lobbying from the industry to allow more data centres to connect to the grid. The grid is blocked, used up, 18% of our grid is used up by data centres just to fuel them alone. And it is estimated that will rise to 30% by 2030, which is only like 5 years away, 5 or 6 years away. And we've had orange warnings and stuff on the grid in the Dublin area, because most of them are located in the Dublin area and they want to be located in the Dublin area, and they've been lobbying to locate in the Dublin area. Now, remember, these are mainly used by companies like Amazon, Twitter, Microsoft, all the big techie industries who are all located, headquartered here because of the tax breaks that they get. And now they also want a break on the proliferation of data centres. I think it's shameful. It's out of kilter with the rest of the planet. Most countries will not allow more than 4% of the national grid go to use to, on data centres. And the other issue, which goes under the radar, is the amount of water that they use. A small data centre would use 500,000 litres of water per day. And now we're talking about taking water from the Shannon to Dublin while we're feeding our water to these centres. And the other kind of more political issue is, we don't know what they're used for. Most of the data that is stored in these centres is mainly for advertising, to get you and me to buy more stuff. You know, more stuff for your kitchen, more clothes, more shoes. That's what it's used for. And so there's never been a national discussion or dialogue about what do we need in terms of data. Yes, we all have our phones and we're connected and we can watch Netflix. That's a small percentage of what this this industry does. And so I think there needs to be a national discussion on it, an absolute ban on any more coming onto the national grid. And if there's renewable energy, as Grainne described there, we need that to fuel homes, hospitals, schools, transport system, to electrify the whole country and to move away from fossil fuels.
No, yeah. Look, I think we need to get a bit real on this. Like, we all use data centres. We all use for everything. If you're listening to this broadcast right now via streaming, you're using a data centre. If you're browsing the web, you're using a data centre.
I acknowledge that now. It's still a small percentage.
Advertising is not the biggest percentage. It is absolutely not the biggest percentage by any means. The amount of data used in Ireland right now and in other countries is astronomical, and it's growing year on year. For instance, to do operations via AI, for example,
the storage of your data and my data and her data and his data is what they mainly do. It's called dark data, and they store how we behave, what we do, what we look at, in order to promote other products.
But that's storage. That is the main. It's not active.
But that's what data centres do. They store data.
Okay, but to the broader point as to whether or not they should be
being accessed and being downloaded and uploaded. That's what data centres do. Yes, they store data, but it actually takes a lot less energy usage to store data.
Well, let's not go too far down the rabbit hole of what the data is used for. Let's go back to the data centres themselves and the fact that they haven't been connected in some time. Is that a problem, Noel, or would you be of Breed's view that they should be banned until, and not even until, they should be just banned?
I'd be diametrically opposed to Breed's view here on this one. Like, I mean, the reality is that by not connecting more data centres here right now, we're doing two things. First of all, we're economically restricting ourselves potentially where these companies might have to review their operations arising from the fact that their staff base isn't necessarily where their data is, and that can become problematic logistically and operationally for these companies. Secondly, though, and this is the crucial bit, I guess, Breed says we have more data centres here than other countries. That is true, but there is a reason underpinning that. One reason is because the companies are mostly headquartered here, but the second reason, and the more crucial reason in a way, is because our climate and our temperature is actually a good place for these data centres to be based. If we don't
not in Iceland, then.
If we don't base them here, If we don't base them here in this country, what happens instead? They go to less suitable countries. Iceland, for example, would be less suitable because of the extreme cold that it has for much of the year. Say the continental Europe
nonsense.
Would be less.
You're talking nonsense. Honestly, you're talking absolute
nonsense. I'm absolutely
not
talking nonsense.
Most
you have to maintain a static and stable temperature.
The only one next highest to us is Singapore, which is also a tax haven. They allow for 11%. We've gone up to 18% and we're likely to go to 30% of the national grid being soaked up by data usage. Now, it's crazy. Most countries will not allow it go beyond 4%. Ask yourself why. And it's not about climate. And actually, Noel, they don't provide that many jobs. Yes, they provide jobs in the construction, but a handful of people actually work in them.
Can I ask a question in this, Bree, just to be clear? What happens if, because a lot of the big tech are obviously based here and are hugely profitable to us being here. If they get the message that says, look, we'll take the high-end cream bit of your foreign direct investment, but the data centres that are the foundation on which you operate, we don't want them, send them elsewhere. Does that not risk sending a message that we don't want you at all?
Look, I'm not talking about shutting them all down that are already here. And there are like something like 80-odd of them. There's another, I don't know, I can't remember the figures. I'm sorry, Sunday morning, I can't remember all the figures. But there's dozens more in the planning process. And there's more looking to be built. The proliferation of data centres in this country is crazy. It's crazy for the environment. It's crazy in terms of energy and water usage. It does not make sense. And if they go elsewhere, then they go elsewhere.
Okay,
I mean,
Gráinne,
the fact that they're data centres means that they can interchange the data wherever they are in the world.
There is a clash of approach here where the Irish government is trying to use appropriately funds from tax from multinational companies while also saying we're banning an expansion of it. And, you know, the government has warned repeatedly that there is a chance and a likelihood that, you know, a change in economy or global climate and these tech giants can leave at any time. So what happens then when if those tech giants do leave and we are left with a high number of data centres as well? I'm not really sure what happens in that scenario either. So I think the government need a long-term strategy on the tech giants in general. At the moment, it seems like a wait and hope and see what happens. You'd forget who is the government of the country, kind of who is the rule makers here.
Absolutely.
I think it's one of the major weaknesses of the Irish state is when it comes to big companies, we don't feel we can stand up to them.
Well, to that point, Noel, and this goes to what Breed was saying, surely there is a point where you begin to say, OK, we have to state our GDP in two separate ways because we have so much in the way of FDI. Mm-hmm. We have fallen over ourselves to facilitate FDI. We have about a fifth of our entire grid going to support data centres. There comes a point where you surely should be able to say we're a sovereign nation. We don't have to keep capitulating regardless of how much money you give us.
The nation doesn't have to do anything, of course, and that's why there's been a moratorium on these things for a number of years now in terms of the additional data centres in the country. I suppose the point I'm making is that if we do this indefinitely, there is an increasing challenge or systemic risk, if you like, in keeping these companies here prospectively. But the one thing I would say is, you know, our earlier discussion on migration, for example, we touched on the theme that we're in a global economy, in a global society. That's true for people and the movement of people. It's also true for data and the movement of data as well. Ultimately, this data has to be hosted somewhere. So yes, Breed, it doesn't have to be here, but actually it's probably better and more beneficial, both environmentally overall, rather than being in a less suitable country.
You know nothing about climate change or the environment, if that's what you really think.
I think I know quite a bit about this topic.
If we have to move to renewable energy and more than a third of it is going to fuel data centres, that's crazy. We need those renewables to fuel hospitals, homes, schools, transport.
And that's why these companies are proposing to bring about a more renewable regime when it comes to connecting new companies.
I mean, even the proposal about renewable gas, that is a technology that hasn't yet been devised. And they're talking about introducing it by 2028. It hasn't been devised yet. It's not proven to work.
Your licence fee proposal was predicated on taxing advertising, and now you're saying, let's take the data centres out of the country. Let's not have as many of them here anymore.
It seems like your policies aren't disconnected. That's it. Stop it. No more. I've put a bill before the Dáil to ban the proliferation of data centres. No more. We have enough. 18% of the national grid. If we give them all planning permission and let them build, it'll be 30% in 5 years' time.
So we'll access
nuts.
The data further
Absolutely
away.
Absolutely nuts. In terms of our environment, our use of water, our use of energy.
It's not drinking the water.
Come in, Breed, with a text that you were like, is Breed Smith the only evolved voice in the room? We are in a climate catastrophe It is just incredible that people believe that we should nurture these tech giants. And it is hashtagged infuriating, which is the first time I've had a hashtag come in via text. Another, it doesn't matter to companies where data centers are built, but environmentally data centers should be in cooler countries. Although to Noel Rock's point, the issue may be that they may like to have them linked to where they have other operations. Exactly. And you may end up losing
like
one
to
fit with the other.
They may like to have their cake and eat it and the rest of us suffer and the environment suffers.
Breed is hugely disappointed that we don't have enough time to get to the other story that's on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, which is the inside story of Eamon and Ruth's shock split. This is Eamon Holmes and Ruth Langford, who are apparently getting divorced. The reason she is disappointed is because we've spent most of the previous ad breaks explaining to her who both of them are so that we can discuss it. Unfortunately, we don't have time to get there. Guys, thank you very much. That is Breed Smith from People Before Profit, Noel Rock, former Fine Gael TD, and Gráinne Nié.
The Anton Savage Show
with Kiri's.ie
on News Talk.